Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from the Berlin-based Think and Do Tank Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy and security. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayer.
And I'm Alexandra Steinkraus. In this series, you will hear from experts and practitioners offering their take on climate foreign policy, climate-related impacts to security, and promoting peace and resilience in a changing climate. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow at climatediplo on Twitter.
Hello and welcome back to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast. Hi everyone. Today Raquel and I will do a deep dive into an issue that we, and I'm willing to guess many of our listeners also work on a daily basis, livelihoods and how they relate to climate, peace and security.
If you're new to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, every now and then we pick a topic for these host-to-host deep dives, so we get to deviate a bit from our usual interview format to have a chat and bring you some of the insights that we are ourselves dealing with in our daily work. We've already had some chats like this in the past on food security, maladaptation, and farmer-herder conflict, so do check them out if you've missed them.
So livelihoods are a determinant factor in so many contexts, in social, economic, climate, environment, security, and also development spheres, just to name quite a few. As a word that can literally be found in almost every single report out there, we hope today to bring you some interesting insights about livelihoods today. So let's get right into it. Tell us, Raquel, in fact, what are livelihoods?
That's an amazing question. We should never underestimate the power of defining terms because we use them so much and sometimes we just skip over that part. So yeah, first off, what do we mean even when we say livelihoods? Now, when we speak of livelihoods, at least in the climate and the environmental and perhaps also in the development spheres, we are speaking primarily of subsistence strategies, so which mostly include an economic element. And it means the activities people conduct in order to have an income or for sustaining themselves in some way, also if it doesn't involve income in the most classic way. And just to give an example of that, if a person will be exchanging work for housing and food, there might not be a typical money exchange involved, but their work is providing them with subsistence. So this could be seen as a livelihood strategy too. This is just an example. And this brings us to a crucial point, I'd say, which is the difference between livelihood security and food security, because we often see these terms together almost as if they're one. And of course, the reason for this is that they do overlap so much, because when someone's livelihood is affected, their ability to purchase food is impaired. So of course, their livelihood insecurity can very quickly spiral into food insecurity. And that's why they're often seen as one thing or together. But we do need to distinguish between these two because they sometimes are not directly connected. And just to give an example of a situation in which this would not be the case, let's take a farmer who produces food, right? Maybe vegetables, grains, milk products. But let's say there's food price fluctuations or perhaps economic crisis happening in their country. They aren't able to sell their produce or they get only very low prices for it. So this person, they might have an abundance of food or even end up dumping large amounts of food because transportation and storage costs are at the moment higher than they are getting for selling the food. But their livelihood, their source of income is endangered. Of course, this is just an example to demonstrate the ways in which food security might not be directly entangled with livelihood security. But to be fair, this is a rather reductionist example, really just to show that they can be separated. Because in today's world, most farmers, they will produce a very low variety of products, oftentimes just one. So if you can't sell it, it's not like you can live from it. It's not like you're going to be food secure because you're consuming your maize. That's not how it works, of course. Reality is always more complex than these examples. So yeah, in most cases, food and livelihood insecurity are directly connected, but just to make the point that it doesn't have to be this way. And this is important because if you're thinking of pathways of climate-related risks that are behind livelihood insecurity, also how to address them, the risks and also the entry points will be quite different than those of food insecurity, right?
Yeah, I guess this is a really good point because, for example, you can't address livelihood and security by providing something like food aid or humanitarian aid, for example. There needs to be different entry points to help solve the problem.
Exactly. That's why the distinction is so important. And let's explore then these pathways that I just mentioned. So, if you're a regular listener of our podcast, hopefully you are, you know already that in our work, we like to work with pathways as a way to break down these larger climate and security patterns into their individual risks. And we do this in order to identify entry points, among others. And it works like this. So, if you imagine a line, right? When you have on the one side of the line, you have a climate impact, and on the other side of the line, you have a conflict situation. The pathway methodology helps us to look at everything that is happening between those two. So, factors that are intermediary, that are facilitating a climate impact to being translated into an insecurity risk, because it's not direct. It's not like you have a climate impact and immediately you have a conflict. There are other things that have to happen in between, and the pathway methodology, the pathway logic helps us unravel what these things are. And Alex, maybe you can tell our listeners a little bit more about the pathway methodology.
Of course. Thanks for, I think I've actually never heard you present this little visual explainer before, and I'm going to save it in my brain for the future because I think that's very, very helpful. And I hope I'm not going to get too nerdy or in-depth with the methodology, so I'm going to count on you, Raquel, to hold me back if I dive in a little bit too deep. But I want to start us off by taking a little bit of a step back and thinking through these different elements of kind of our climate security assessment approach, of which climate security pathways are at the center of them. So there are climate and environmental stressors, which are climate changes and their direct impacts. So this includes things like temperature rise and its impacts on agriculture, which is especially relevant for our discussion today, and also things like flooding and its impact on infrastructure and some non-climate related environmental issues like pollution. All of those are in the sphere. Then there's the peace and security context, which you've alluded to, and that includes things like history of the region, country, the state of the economic, social, and political stability, or often instability, and things like past and ongoing security risks and conflict dynamics and drivers that are the cause of this insecurity. And then these interactions between the two different components, our climate impacts and peace and security, are what we're referring to as climate security risk pathways. And I know I already said we're taking a step back, but before diving deeper into these different pathways, I also want to mention that context factors are really important, and these shape vulnerability as well as resilience to the risks, and they're also really important to this kind of analysis. So these factors that both increase vulnerability and the risk of climate impacts contributing to instability and conflict, and increase the resilience of communities, societies, and states to withstand compounding climate security risks. They include a lot of different factors, like economic factors, for example, access to opportunities, the climate sensitivity of economic activities, and access to things like market. See, I'm staying on topic. And it
There's
also
quite a
includes,
lot.
yeah.
But actually, one thing I noticed also in all the work that we do is that from all these factors, well, they are all super important and some come up more than others. But I've seen, at least, I don't know if you had the same experience, but the history of conflict being such an important one of the most determining factors.
Exactly. Yeah. Whether conflict has happened in the past can often be the most important determining factor of conflict in the future. And I think here, like that spans quite a few of these different context factors and is also directly in this kind of peace and security context that is also interacting in. And as you've mentioned, there are a lot of different factors. So we have social factors, which include gender equality, which I think is at the heart of quite a few of the examples we'll get into later in the episode. And social cohesion, political and legal factors that include opportunities for political participation, trust in these institutions, and also things like demographic makeup and trends like population size, density, growth, urbanization, which we'll come to as well when we talk about migration a little bit later, and age. So these are the different kinds of context factors that shape our climate-related security risks and are very important as we move forward and identify responses. So then we actually have our climate security risk pathways, and these are used to unpack how specific climate impacts and security risks are interacting. And in our weathering risk methodology, as a starting point, we identify five indicative pathways as a starting point for analysis. And coming back to what we really want to talk about in this episode and why we're here is one of the pathways that we use as a starting point is that climate change impacts undermine livelihoods, affect human mobility, and can push people into illegal coping mechanisms. And this is a starting point that we offer for different forms of analysis. And we want to get into some more examples and don't only want to speak about the methodological framework today. Maybe apparently I do a little bit because I keep talking about it, but
if we like it that much, maybe our listeners like it too.
Maybe. I really hope that it's been helpful.
Do let us know, listeners, if you like these analytical framework methodology conversations. We can have many more of those.
Certainly. And before we move on to examples, I just want to note one small thing since I've mentioned migration like a few times in this little intro is that, and I think since we had the episode with Andrew Harper, migration has been on my mind since I think September when we recorded that episode. But migration is not inherently causing these tensions or conflict that we'll talk about, but it can create tensions or exacerbate things within underserved host communities and kind of stretch capacities in rapidly growing urban areas, for example, which we'll also talk on a little later on. I think it comes up in example with Kenya. But as we go into the episode, I just wanted to note the caveat there that it isn't migration being an inherently bad thing. Okay, but then I think over to you, Raquel, for an example of a pathway, maybe.
Absolutely. That's a point that we can't make enough, right? To not put all the burden on migration, because that's an easy one to get misunderstood. So thanks for that. Yeah, let's get into some examples. I was thinking about what would be a good example to demonstrate this. And one that came to my mind is just the land, the use of land, land accessibility, and so on and so forth. Because if we think about excluding the service economy, most livelihoods will involve land in one way or another. So owning land, or at least having access to lands that are publicly owned, it's crucial for the production of raw materials or collection of raw materials like food. But also we think about food always, but there's also fibers, there are minerals and fuel. So if you have any issues standing on the way of land ownership or land access, this will inherently impact livelihoods directly or indirectly. And we can see examples like this everywhere in the world, really in every continent. And some of the key issues behind there are urbanization. So just the encroachment of urban areas and infrastructure like roads that are taking up land. A very common issue in developing countries as well are when land corporations are grabbing land from local populations for large-scale agriculture, for example. And of course, very importantly, gender dynamics. There are still many places in the world in which women either cannot own land or they technically can by law, but they barely do because virtually only males inherit land. So let's say even if a woman's family will own land, it's probably her brother or her husband or her son who will inherit it. So this is an issue, especially when these women are left behind and they don't have land. And this happens quite a lot in economic types of migration when males move for work and women stay behind. And if they don't own land, they often don't have a livelihood. And we also have the issue that women will, of course, earn much less for paid work, as we know, everywhere in the world. And women are often busy. They have less availability because they are burdened with unpaid care work for children, for elderlies, for communities. So also, even their ability to make money to purchase land will be reduced compared to men in the same place. So you already have all these factors in place. Then climate change comes on top of it, gives it a final blow to their livelihoods. Either it comes suddenly through a climate impact that wipes out harvests or destroys crops, or it can also come slowly through soil deterioration, reduced soil quality, reduced water availability, impacting yields and just overall increasing unfavorable weather for crops and animals.
And then I think one other example that I want to mention before we get, I guess, even into some additional ones is an overt reliance on farm income and climate shocks and how that can lead to vulnerability. So over-reliance on income from farming and dependency on farming-related livelihoods, including pastoralism, can leave populations vulnerable to the shocks of climate change. And for example, in some countries, the pastoral economy can comprise up to 90% of all employment opportunities and up to 95% of family income in some instances. So you have these cases where as rain is becoming more unpredictable, intense, oftentimes followed by flash floods and high levels of runoff, which can lead to lots of water loss, and then it can't actually seep through the soil and reach the roots of plants to help them grow. So then these cycles of drought and flooding leave communities even more vulnerable to climate shocks when they're dependent on it for income. And as I think we mentioned, the difference between food insecurity at the beginning and livelihoods, and here this is one of those things that is often interlinked, right? This is a good example of that, where of course, when we have these kinds of extreme weather phenomenon and food can't grow, that can lead to things like food insecurity. But then on the same hand, when you have, say, upwards of 90% or large majorities of the population who rely on farming as their source of income, you kind of have both things happening where people cannot support themselves, they're not able to provide for their families, and there's also food shortages.
That's a compound crisis right there.
Exactly.
And I know I used before this imaginary line to depict a pathway, but of course, pathways are nothing but linear. Just coming back to reality, it's more like a squiggle.
That's true. I am a fan of the circular pathway. They take up quite a bit of space in things like publications. but when there's space for them, I think they're nice. I think also people understand things linearly. So while they can be much more complex than starting point A to B, they're certainly helpful to understand some of these phenomena.
And you know what? In this case, we can't even draw a full circle, because if we're thinking, we were talking about now how climate change is impacting livelihoods, but we can also go back and think of, you know, go full circle and think of how livelihood insecurity itself can accelerate climate change and environmental degradation.
Yeah, it could lead to practices that are unsustainable, even harmful to the environment. And yeah, maybe we really should think about the circular pathway a little bit
totally.
More.
Maybe next we can connect episode. To the circular economy and see if those things overlap somehow. Surely we'll do.
Surely.
Yeah, if we're thinking on how this happens, right? If we're describing the pathway, if we have harvests that are unpredictable, a farmer will be much more inclined to increase their area of production to have better chances of producing enough to guarantee its livelihood. And it might even encroach in natural areas that are important for mitigating climate change, like forests, like grasslands, which are super important, mangroves, things we don't talk about enough, I think so, in the climate community. And this is called extensive agriculture. And it's something that we desperately need to contain if we want to have a fighting chance against a changing climate. But then on the other hand, there's also the intensification of agriculture, which is when you attempt to produce as much as you can with the little resources that you have at hand. So with farmers being in a situation of vulnerability, they might end up overusing a little parcel of land that they have and really doing several croppings, one on top of each other, one season after each other, without giving the time for the soil to recover. This, of course, ends up speeding the rate at which the land is degraded. We spoke a little bit about this. It's called soil mining, and in the deep dive that we had a while ago on food security. So check it out if you're interested. But just to mention quickly that this is a bit of a trickier one, in case maybe some listeners are saying, hey, wait a minute, that's not always bad. It's a tricky one because some people would argue that agriculture intensification can be a good thing in the sense that it can be an alternative to extensive agriculture, which is always bad. And it's a way to maximize resource efficiency, which is something we should do, right? It's just that doing intensification right comes with having technical knowledge and resources or indigenous knowledge of regenerative practices. So it's not available to anyone. And in the end of the day, whether you do it in the better or a worse way, intensifying agriculture to one space and to a limited number of resources will still speed up the degradation of those resources inherently. which is why it is also one of the pathways to livelihood insecurity.
Yeah, I think natural resource management is always one of the topics that I also have a difficult time separating out from livelihoods when talking about these things. So I think in our weathering risk synthesis report, I think in some of the final opportunities, it ended up being food security and livelihoods, natural resource management and livelihoods, and then migration and livelihoods, because I just couldn't in the end separate them out. So maybe we should have done this podcast episode before then, and it would have been a little bit more straightforward for me.
Oh, I guess this is just reflecting the reality of how difficult it is to separate these things. We have to separate them in order to talk about them, but we also have to think of them holistically. It's a challenge for practitioners, so we might as well just suffer live.
No, that's a really good point, this holistic approach, because in the end, I think it's good if we can define these concepts, but in the end, it's actually beneficial if the recommendations or the opportunities that are identified, these different entry points actually address these intersecting things at the same time. So speaking of weathering risk, I also want to share some localized examples from some case studies that we've conducted and how they interact with pre-existing insecurity dynamics and can drive different things like armed recruitment, maladaptation, conflict, migration. So first of all, I think I have three examples that I'd really like to share, and maybe we'll start with Mali and then we'll move further east. So in Mali, during some of the work that was conducted there, one of the climate security pathways is that climate change and conflict, both separately and together, are impacting livelihoods and also in many cases blocking adaptation, and then therefore affecting social cohesion, which can lead to things like different kinds of violence or conflict. So we have this ongoing in Mali, and actually in this case, a lot of respondents to some of these interviews and surveys, they spoke directly about the effects of the changing climate on livelihoods, where there was reduced depth, shrinking and silting of water bodies, and that made it difficult for fisher folk to navigate and contributed to the disappearance of different fish species, which thrived and reproduced in some of these deeper waters that they no longer had access to. And also the length of fishing season was drastically reducing.
Doesn't our assessment in Mali have very interesting interactive page? I'm just remembering now that this might be something that our listeners might be interested in if they're working with the region.
Yeah, that's a really good point. If you go to the Weathering Risk website, or I guess also probably the podcast description, since we'll write this after the episode, there is a kind of multimedia story on Mali that uses some photojournalism that was produced, as well as highlight some of the key quotes from this assessment, and has a lot of images and also some video interviews. So I guess if you like these kind of formats, like the podcast and listening, or if you like to visualize some of these findings, we'll link that in the description because it's a really nice thing to explore.
And it's even in French. I'm seeing now that we also have the French versions of it, which is great.
Yes, the report itself is in French. So that's accessible to numerous different people. So yeah, then speaking of Mali, in addition to kind of these additional stresses on fish, both in terms of variety and availability in people's livelihoods, people have also adapted through alteration of techniques, movement to new areas, and trying to diversify livelihoods and engage in new and sometimes illicit trades. And actually in the north, this was particularly driven by opportunities for more profitable livelihoods, but also social mobility and protection. However, the extent and already tangible climate change, as well as the conjunction of insecurity, could in some cases serve to block adaptation. And this kind of happened in three different ways. So climate change measures could negatively impact others. For example, here, the use of chemical fertilizers, now coming to farming, pesticides, herbicides on farmlands, well, they temporarily resulted in higher crop yields. It led to degraded agricultural land in the medium to long term. And then coming back to the fish also had a negative impact by killing some of the fish when chemicals are swept into rivers by heavy rains.
Now, a little bit of what we were talking about, the intensification beforehand. I mean, you get higher yields if you use the chemicals. You do get it and understand why farmers would revert to that. But then you degrade your land much faster and you reduce your capability of having livelihoods in that same land with those same resources in the future. So you're kind of buying from the future.
Certainly. And then migration, especially in Mali, is also another key adaptation strategy. And seasonal, circular, cross-border, and short-term migration have been a way of life for many generations. However, about a decade ago, these migration changes started to shift, and these patterns shifted in favor of longer, more permanent southward and urban migration, in part due to some of these ecological climate conflict factors. And then this created a culture of receptiveness of newcomers in southern Mali. And this had been the case prior to this. And this kind of new influx of different migration and different migration patterns weakened this receptiveness and this high number of migrants coming in and increasing higher population density kind of changed some of the social cohesion in the area. And then also kind of on this social cohesion note, the diversification of livelihoods in the case of Mali, in some case also led to reduced contact between groups, I think, which just goes to show, I'm sure we'll come back to livelihood diversification, but it's really important that it's thought out and that people who are directly impacted are also brought into these processes to make sure that there aren't any of these kind of maladaptation or mal effects.
And that's an interesting one because livelihood diversification pops up as an entry point for addressing this kind of overt reliance on farm income, also in the light of, okay, we can't always just adapt our crops. We just have to adapt the livelihood strategy itself. So that is a very common entry point. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting to know that you can also have some, unintended impacts.
I think that's a good point. It's an important entry point, but it's also important that it's done right and not just thrown out as, okay, we need to diversify livelihoods, but really thinking through what that means and not only the short-term impacts on the communities involved, but also thinking through to the medium and the long term. Okay, so now, as I said, let's move a little farther east. And just from Kenya, I think we've already talked a bit about mobility patterns in the case of Mali, so I will keep it short and to the point. So in Kenya, deteriorating livelihood conditions, changing mobility patterns, and livestock migration are contributing again to this rural to urban stress and food insecurity. So in some pastoral areas, declining forage and water resources have kept livestock in dry season grazing areas and continuing to migrate further in search of pasture and water and these kind of shifting transhumance pathways, which has been a really important livelihood strategy for a long, long time, is starting to be impacted. And in Kenya, one of the things when it comes to migration that we saw in this research that I want to mention that you already alluded to is the strong gender dimension, which is really apparent here. So traditionally, men are responsible for livestock and therefore are especially challenged by this decreasing livestock rates and moving to new rural settlements entirely, or often urban centers in search of income and employment. And this often means that women and children are left behind, and then they are in a position to need to cope with the additional burden of sustaining household food, water, as well as just general human security, especially in contexts where conflict or violence is occurring. And then here, like school attendance rates can decrease, child labor often increases, and then conflicts over scarce natural resources can often intensify as well.
And this was from our work in partnership with the World Food Program, is that right?
Exactly, exactly. So this was part of this facility in East Africa, where mm-hmm. we partnered with the World Food Program to also provide them with some entry points to make sure that their work on food security was also conflict sensitive. And here, is a good example of food and livelihoods being so
crossing
closely
over.
intertwined. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I mean, we can't really separate those, I guess.
In
Was
this
just
case,
say, yeah. The point was just to say, look, there's a reason why there are different terms to define them.
Certainly. And also important for the podcast that we don't come out with a special edition 3-hour episode where we just
talk about everything that crosses over life.
Exactly.
That would be crazy. Yeah.
Special edition 50th, 100th episode, maybe.
The one that requires most patience from our listeners. Yeah. Interesting one on Kenya.
Exactly. So then, very last one, I said we would continue to move farther east, and now I just want to come to the Pacific.
Are you really fulfilling your promise with this?
See, a little step and then a bit of a jump over to the Pacific. And here also fisheries comes up in our work in the Pacific. One of the things, climate change, of course, challenges livelihoods. And this is where the blue economy came up once again. So warming seas, acidification, coastal erosion, which of course, coastal erosion in the Pacific island states, incredibly significant, especially when there's so many cities positioned along the coasts.
Super existential. I mean,
yeah,
I don't know. Maybe 70% of some islands could be on the coast. That's, super relevant.
Yeah. So all of these phenomenon and then storms, some human activities that are degrading marine ecosystems, reducing biodiversity, agriculture is being threatened by the increased heat in the region and the shifting of different rainfall patterns, and then saltwater intrusion from storm surges, sea level rise, which all can kind of lead to these reduced yields. So here again, affecting livelihoods as well as food. And we've talked about fish quite a bit. So then I think one of the things, especially when it comes to livelihood diversity, that is interesting when it comes to the Pacific is in the past, and I guess even still present, tourism has thought to be a generally underdeveloped industry across many of the Pacific islands and has been seen as a possible growth sector. But like even this kind of possibility of diversification is threatened by climate change with risk to this coastal erosion, threatening the very nice beaches, and also the rising sea level, not only is submerging cities, but also submerging like really important cultural heritage sites amongst other kind of climate risks. And this biodiversity loss and the natural beauty of these islands, which could potentially serve as a different form of livelihood diversification, is also under threat here as well.
I remember a few years ago, I had an interview with Coral Pazizi, who's also a member of the Climate Security Network.
Yes, and the Weathering Risk
Network.
And the Weathering Risk Strategic Advisory Board. Yeah.
So, yeah, we can definitely say she's a strong partner of us. It was not an interview for the podcast. It was for when we were preparing the massive open online course on climate change and security together with 5 UN bodies. And she was talking about how the fisheries, because of climate change and then the water temperature change and the fish stocks are just moving towards other directions and actually leaving their economic area of many of the Pacific islands. So maybe going, for example, to the US and they don't have now legally the right to fish anymore because it already moved away from their waters, which is crazy. That's such a big thing. I mean, it's like, I don't know, in certain countries, almost all in the smaller islands, let's say, that have very little land available, almost all of their income will come from fisheries.
Yeah. These exclusive economic zones are really an important point to hit here. And I'm glad that you mentioned Coral because she last year briefed the UNSC on kind of the threat to peace and security in the Pacific as a result of climate change. And she used some of this research that was done in collaboration with UNDP Pacific, as well as the Pacific Island Forum to inform that briefing. And then I think one more thing I'll say before finally giving you the floor to share a few examples, just because I haven't mentioned it yet, is the disproportionate impact on the youth. And especially that can be seen in the Pacific quite a bit. And they're often especially affected by unemployment across the different Pacific Islands. And this is especially true for urban youth who can sometimes develop negative coping mechanisms, like turning to things like substance abuse or criminality. And then this, of course, has multiple different further impacts, like negative mental health effects in the medium and long term, and just the reality that some precedent in the region as unemployed male youth can succumb to gang behavior and criminal violence.
Super interesting, not pathways that we would traditionally think about.
Yeah,
but we should, because every time we identify a risk, we are also identifying an entry point. That's the whole game with the pathway, and that's why we work with it.
Exactly.
Just to hit home the point. Yeah, and now maybe looking at more the regional or global levels, even we can see that threats to livelihoods, they can come from different directions. So we had climate change, so let's just stay on that train. The example of climate change, we know it can affect livelihoods directly. It can impact crops with floods, drought, pests, and everything that is associated to it. But there's also the other side of the coin, which is how climate change impacts can affect the trade economy. So let's say you're a farmer, and this season your cropland did not suffer any major climate impact, all is going well, you had a great harvest. However, another country, maybe a neighbor, or perhaps even at a completely different part of the world, but it's a recipient of your produce, and they have suffered major climate impacts and blows to their local livelihoods. So it means that a lot of people there, for the country that you would be selling your produce, a lot of people's incomes there have been severely impacted this year because of the climate impact. This now will trickle down to you because your buyer's purchasing capabilities is diminished or gone. So basically, a climate impact in a region far away from yours can affect your livelihood.
I think that's a really good point, especially as we've talked about these different localized examples, which are incredibly important to understand the context in which these are happening. But the implications of something like climate change are cross-border. And even though we need to look at these local communities, there's often impacts in totally different regions and corners of the globe.
Totally. I know it's cliche, but we have to say it because it's true. Climate change knows no borders. And in climate change is this ongoing issue that just keeps getting worse and leaves no region of the world untouched. So we know we will have to deal with this for the foreseeable future. But then all other insecurity dynamics, they don't just stop because we have climate change, right? In fact, they arguably get worse because of it. But if we look at other stressors, we can think of how the COVID pandemic, it affected farmers who couldn't transport their produce across borders, or also farm workers who couldn't reach their workplace and so on. We actually have an episode on how the pandemic impacted climate and security if you're interested, so take a look. And then there are the impacts of conflicts, of course, which are increasing. Conflicts are increasing globally. So that's super relevant, super current. And that can either be happening close to or on your land, so making it impossible for you to produce, or it can be in your region, so that farmers in those countries where the conflict is happening are having to sell their produce to your country because their economy is collapsing. We're seeing this today with Russia's war in Ukraine, and also the impact that the grains that are coming from Ukrainian farmers into the European Union is having on the livelihoods of European, especially Eastern European farmers, plus all the political radicalization that comes with this. And if we think Europe, I mean, that this is a fairly stable economy that tends to cushion, buffer these impacts for farmers. And things are really still heating up pretty badly here slowly. So I can imagine what happens in countries or in the regions that cannot offer this kind of safety networks, right? And what happens, we quickly mentioned this before, what happens is that farmers who lost their incomes, they will often see themselves forced to take up unsustainable or even criminal activities, like we've seen with poppy farming in Afghanistan for the production of drugs, of opium, coal production in Somalia, which is associated with lots of forest clearing, and even transnational criminal activities like illegal logging, illegal mining, wildlife trade, all of which are both detrimental to the environment and to climate subsequently, but also support the criminal economies, right? And these types of maladaptation activities, they're really bad news, both for climate and environment and for human security. We've done a deep dive episode on maladaptation a while ago. Do check it out. Alex, please hold me. I'm doing so many plugs today. Stop me now.
This is going to be an interesting description on like the Podomatic site. Usually we have 3 to 4 resources to link, but I guess when the two of us get talking, I think we've
we'll
mentioned
be 34.
Seven. Yeah, no, more like that high.
But yeah, maybe we can stop talking risks and go straight into the entry points, because those are where the cookie crumbles.
Yes, exactly. So then these entry points would be then the next step of this kind of methodological framework that we've been talking about, is we identify these climate security risk pathways in order to figure out what the entry points are and what recommendations can be made to help drive more sustainable peace, but also sustainability in some cases in these different contexts. So a few examples of some entry points that we've identified in different pieces of work and some from different case studies. So one entry point could be supporting efforts to strengthen climate resilience in itself. And this could look like increased investment in anticipatory action, which I think is something I don't think we've actually touched on yet, but the importance of investing in anticipatory action and not only being reactive. So prioritizing investments in resilient livelihoods, averting the need for continued humanitarian responses, which are important for sustainable solutions, and then making investments in addressing these underlying fragilities that can turn into shocks and stresses and then can cascade into humanitarian crises. And this, in the end, more sustainable and more cost-effective to focus on something like anticipatory action. And then this could also look like supporting the identification of locally appropriate and sustainable livelihood diversification opportunities, which we've mentioned locally appropriate, incredibly important here, because even though livelihood diversification is something we talk about frequently, it can be a negative thing if not done correctly. And in terms of diversification of livelihoods, looking into things that are climate smart and can help mitigate further environmental damage, especially notably for pastoral communities.
Let's leave a recommendation here for the policymakers and practitioners listening to us today. If you're looking to recommend livelihood diversification in a context, do consult with the local population. Right, Alex?
Please do. Yes, we should have contextually informed and locally informed solutions. I think otherwise we're really not going to get anywhere. And as we've talked about today, can actually do more harm than good in many cases. And then I think
we actually have a practical note on inclusion, but I'm not sure I still have credit to plug something else. That might be a bit too much. But we do. We have a practical note on inclusion in case you're needing some very practical examples of how to do that.
I think that's
put
fine.
Together by practitioners, actually. We had a workshop with a group of people with experience on inclusion that helped us inform the practical notes. So it's a cool one. So sorry for another plug, but we do believe in what we say.
We do. And it's also a bit of a different output that I think up until this point, we haven't put out so often, but something that is very clear on recommendations step forward, and also very clear to the groups of people who are intended to take it up. So I think a worthwhile additional resource to plug, certainly. And of course, the workshop was held in the context of the Berlin Climate and Security Conference.
Another plug. No.
Now I feel like I'm just, which Alina and I did a podcast episode on in 2022.
True, yeah. A recap.
Exactly.
And also a lot of the sessions and all of the, we had 5 years already or six?
Last year was five. Last year was the 5th edition. Yep.
Wow, that's incredible. And we have so many recordings back in that. I mean, I guess our community probably knows about the Berlin Climate Security Conference. I would think so.
Now I'm just turning it into a bit to see how many different products we can reference throughout the episode.
We can't help because what we're doing today is talking about what we work with.
Exactly. So, we're talking about our work on a daily basis. So I guess maybe I'll just provide one more entry point before we can even move on and talk a little bit more about suggestions for policymakers to wrap up our conversation for today. Because otherwise, I think we clearly could talk for the 3 hours that I joked about at the beginning of this episode.
Oh, yeah. Stop me if you can.
So then one final entry point that I'll share when possible can be addressing pastoral and mobility and migration related to rapid and unplanned movements and increasing urbanization, which is affecting food systems as cities and secondary cities and expanding rural areas struggle to ensure their habitants' food security. I have to full circle. We started off talking about the differences. Now I'm going to partially bring us to a close by talking about some entry points that can address both of these things. And this could look like delivering climate and conflict-sensitive social protection support, such as cash or food transformation programs, which support resilience in the long term. And that long term is very important, that it's not just immediate aid being handed out, but it's thought of through not only the immediate effects. So then this would include opportunities offered by things like mobile telephone banking in urban and informal settlements, just as an example, and then supporting the development of resilient and economically prosperous food systems, very important, integrated across landscapes and based on multi-stakeholder, multi-scalar, and multi-sectoral collaboration. Ending my portion on a note of collaboration and cooperation.
Multi-cooperation. No, I'm kidding. Great. Mobile telephone banking. This is something you wouldn't come up with, right? If you don't talk to local populations.
Exactly.
Get the intel and what do they really need?
Mm-hmm. And what's possible.
Yeah. And what's possible. Yeah. So that's a very interesting one. And although all these recommendations, you know, if you're listening, it just sounds like, okay, more work needs to be done or more resources that need to be invested. But actually, there's a lot to gain in terms of combining goals, right? So countries, they already have so many targets now to achieve in this complex international system that we've created to also solve all the messes that we've been leaving behind. So whether it's on climate, on biodiversity, on land restoration, on plastic and chemical pollution, waste management, there's so many existing targets already that countries have submitted in the context of all the different COPs and the treaties and agendas, and that can be combined actually to support livelihoods. So if you're thinking of regenerative agriculture, for example, which is a practice that will tackle livelihood, it will tackle food security, soil regeneration, and at the same time, it will have benefits for mitigating climate change, for boosting biodiversity. So really a holistic approach. We also have the so-called indigenous knowledge, which is popping up everywhere nowadays in the context of potential solutions to the climate crisis, but it really isn't really being systematically leveraged yet because of lacking inclusion of Indigenous people in decision-making processes. So maybe we can use the opportunity that is being provided by this need to improve livelihood security in order to advance also more inclusive processes that allows us to learn more about sustainable livelihoods, which can also have these co-benefits for nature and climate. It's all about being holistic, the holistic approaches. And of course, policymakers are the best position to find those entry points for combining goals because they are in tune with their country's goals. They know what needs to be achieved. They can really sit down and see how things combine with each other and also get support from the international community, from practitioners in transforming that into reality.
Amazing. I feel like we've kind of wrapped it up on a very nice note. Some potential entry points, examples, and also suggestions for policymakers.
Yeah, I like this talk very much. It was great to talk about livelihood. Yeah, sometimes it's good to just have a talk about the things you work with. And this was a great opportunity. Also great to share it with our listeners.
Yes, I always like when we can do these one-on-ones. It's so nice when we can have a guest and really do a deep dive into their work and some different topics that maybe we don't work with on an everyday basis, but especially as kind of serious as our work can be, I enjoy like having these conversations. It's very nice talking with you.
Cuts a bit through the seriousness, right?
Yeah.
Also, we get to talk more about solutions when we're just having a heart-to-heart than we do when we're at the actual situation of having to describe risks, which is something that, of course, is what is mostly needed at the moment. Like we have partners, they need to know what is the risk so that they can address it. So we end up very much diving headfirst on risks, which is a bit of an ungrateful work, but me and you, we have the space to dream a little bit.
Yes, it's nice when you could do that at the end of a day.
It's very nice. So yeah, that was the Climate Diplomacy Podcast. We talked today about livelihoods, livelihood security. We talked about some of the risks and how the pathways, this we decided that it's a circle, the circle pathways today that are behind and ahead of, that are interacting with livelihood insecurity, basically. We also looked into, yeah, perhaps some entry points to address those. And we hope that you enjoyed it.
Follow our latest updates on Twitter at Climate Diplo. Thank you for tuning in. And until next time, goodbye.
Bye.